The author and screenwriter Stephanie Preisner is in the Cork studio. Good morning, Stephanie.
Good morning, Brendan.
Stephanie, I see from Instagram you've just marked your first year wedding anniversary. How's married life?
Oh, it's actually great, except that my husband has left me to climb Kilimanjaro this week, so I'm having some sort of abandonment issues. But yeah, I don't know, married life, it's not what I thought it would be, in the sense that I was always kind of independent, you know. I was just me on my own, paying my bills and doing my things, and I've just turned into one of those women who's like, what's the login for the board? Gosh, we need a meter reading. Like, the suffragettes would kill me. Like, I've just turned into one of these women who's absolutely useless without her husband.
Or you've made your husband into your slave. Like, there's two ways you can look at that. He's doing the inconvenient stuff. You can't be bothered with.
Well, there is that. It's certainly more convenient for me to let him deal with the admin. But that, it does.
Look, I think if you said to people, what's the best benefit of marriage? Convenience is what they really think, but they don't say it. So fair play to you for admitting it. So, Stephanie, I want to talk to you today about being diagnosed with autism as an adult, which you were. Remind me, when were you diagnosed?
I was diagnosed in, so the process takes a little while, the assessment, but like the day that they actually told me, yes, you are, was the end of September last year.
Okay, so you're still getting your head around it, I imagine. Did you always suspect there was something a bit different about you?
Yes, I did always suspect that there was something different. I never suspected it was autism. In fact, it was suggested to me three times that I get an autism diagnosis, and I just thought, that's absolutely mental. Like, I'm sitting here looking at you, making eye contact, being terrible at maths, not being Rain Man. I'm absolutely not autistic. But before that, I always, like, I'd been in therapy since maybe 2013, because I always felt like I'm just not the same as other people, and there's something wrong, and why am I like this, and why do I struggle so much with different things, and I can't relate to other people. And, you know, I did have a lot of struggles, not particularly making friends, but, you know, keeping friends. And particularly when I went to university, that was when I really noticed, wow, okay, school was fine, I was really good at school. The timetable, the expectations are very clear. You put your hand up, the teacher asks you a question, you get praised for your, you know, learning off of knowledge. And then you go to university and all of a sudden you attend a lecture and you're the only one in the lecture theatre because it's rag week, and the lecturer is actually a little bit thick with you for showing up because now he has to teach the class. But it's on the timetable, like, and that's the rule. Like, I want to attend my lectures. And then other people are partying and being like, oh, we're going to go down to this stranger's house that we've never met and drink some cans of stuff. And, you know, I was like, well, what time are we going to be there, and who's going to be there with us, and what time will we leave? And all of that sort of going to find yourself in university, I found very, very stressful because the expectations were not clear. And that was when I started, I guess, having mental health issues around it and started going to therapy. But sure, all the therapy in the world can't help if you don't know what the thing is that you need to be dealing with.
Yeah. As a child, how were you?
I was hilarious. My mum, it was part of the assessment, you know, they do ask like to look back on your childhood. And as we were filling in the assessment form, it became very clear that, like, we were kind of laughing to ourselves, being like, how did we not know? Like, I was an anxious child and I turned into an anxious adult. But like, when I was at school, I had to know, like, at the end of the summer, I had to know who my teacher was going to be for next year and where my classroom was going to be. And I couldn't just go through the summer without knowing that, which was a difficulty, you know, for my mother, who had to sort of, like, plague principals to be like, could we get the timetable for next year? When, sure, they didn't even know who their staff were going to be. And I took things quite literally. So, you know, my mom would say, I'll meet you on the dot at 3. And at 3, I'd be devastated looking for the dot where I would stand, because she wouldn't be able to find me if I wasn't on the dot. Just taking things quite literally, and needed to know every day what we were going to be having for dinner. And if that changed, even if it was something like, say, we were having bacon and cabbage, and all of a sudden mam picked me up from the childminders and said, oh, we'll go to McDonald's. Even though I would prefer McDonald's, I would get distressed because that wasn't the plan and that was not what she had said. And why did she change her mind? And I really needed predictability.
And what did you put it down to?
I put it down to loads of things. Like my whole life, I put it down to, so my parents are divorced. So a lot of people would have put it down to the fact that I was from a broken home, or that, you know, at some point in my early childhood, my parents had separated. And so that made me need control. Then later in life, it was because I was a Taurus. So that's why I was so stubborn. And that's why I needed, that's why I needed structure. And then, you know, I was born in Germany. My dad is German. So sometimes the fact that I liked to line up my pencils and needed them all the same height was because I was just very organized and German. So it's, you know, it was easy to put different labels on different parts of my autistic traits that explained them away. But when you looked at the whole and you had a psychologist during the assessment, yeah, look at the whole thing, it was very clear, really.
So then what started you then as an adult? What started you thinking about it? Like, what traits did you have as an adult that we would now, you now recognize as being autism?
Well, I'm very direct and I'm quite honest, and I think neurotypical people, which is, you know, a phrase for people who are not autistic, they sort of value politeness over honesty. That's something that I've noticed, and autistic people tend to value honesty over politeness. And so there would be, I always felt a bit of a gap between my communication style and other people's expectations of that. And there was always a bit of kind of tension there. And then I guess it was just overthinking everything and not ever really feeling like I fitted in and not enjoying the things that other adults in my life enjoyed. For example, like I worked in theatre for my late teens, early 20s, and theatre, it's great when you're on stage. You learn your lines, you stand where you're told to stand, the lights come on, rules, you say your thing, yeah, you bow, you leave. But outside of all that, it's a very social environment. There's a lot of alcohol involved. And I found that I wasn't able to tolerate the social aspect of things. I don't like crowds. I don't like talking to people that I don't know about things. Like, I don't like when there's not a reason for a meeting, you know? So when mm-hmm. you're just in a bar with someone, I find that really stressful because I'm like, what are we going to talk about? And so in order to cover that, I would drink excessively, because when I'm drunk, I don't feel the sort of discomfort and the pressure, because you're kind of like, that's why a lot of people drink, you know, right? Just to kind of lubricate the social situation, to wind down, take the edge off, all those sayings that we have. And so then I became very dependent on alcohol, because I couldn't do my life, my social life, without alcohol. And so then for a while I sort of identified as an alcoholic, where I was like, oh, well, I must be an alcoholic because I drink so much. But actually there's a huge overlap in the number of autistic people who have alcohol dependence. And it's because being in social environments is very overwhelming. It's loud, it's unpredictable. People come at you from all sides and touch, lean up against you, touch you. It's, you know, it's very overwhelming. And so people take the edge off with alcohol.
And I didn't know about that overlap, and I didn't know either. There's also an overlap with the eating disorders.
Oh yeah, a huge overlap. This has been like the biggest change that's happened for me since being diagnosed is how much research I've done and how much I've learned. And I have an eating disorder, or had an eating disorder. Sometimes I wonder about what tense you're going to use here, because you know, people say you never really recover from it. But at the moment, it's all going well. But you know, I was very, very underweight. I lost my period for 3.5 years because of it. And I was anorexic. And, you know, if I had been about food, if I had been with trains the way I was about food, tracking them, writing everything down, standing watching them, learning the numbers around them, it would have been very clear that, like, this is autistic behavior. But because it was around food, and because I was a woman, and because weight loss and weight issues are so prevalent, and you know, you're praised so much for losing weight, I didn't really see it as something that was a problem, because I was getting so much positive reinforcement from it. And then I went to, when an endocrinologist said to me, like, you know, you have no estrogen, your hair is falling out, you have osteopenia, which is the start of osteoporosis. Are you willing to gain weight to get your period back and sort yourself out? And I was saying, no, I'm not. And eventually she kind of convinced me to. And so I started doing CBT. But CBT is often not, it's a psychotherapy method that helps people to look at their thoughts and, you know, see if their thoughts are based in evidence. And it doesn't often work for autistic people, because our minds work differently and our use of logic and reason can sort of interrupt the CBT process. Okay. And so once I learned that I was autistic, I was able to see a therapist who specializes in working with autistic people with eating disorders and finally get away to deal with the eating disorder. And so it's just one of those reasons why knowing the way your brain works and knowing that you are autistic is so crucial.
So in terms of the assessment then, so you said a few people had said it to you. What was the tipping point though that led you in to get the actual assessment?
So the first thing, I wrote a book in 2017 and it's called Why Can't Everything Just Stay the Same?
Yeah, that was a red flag right there, wasn't it?
It should have been, shouldn't it?
Why didn't I say something at that time? Yeah.
And it's all about my childhood and my teenage years and all of the changes that I couldn't cope with. It's basically, Adam Harris has since read it. He's a good friend of mine. And he was like, we could hand this out. This is basically a case study in autism.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
But my GP at the time read that book. And she was like, I read your book. It's really great. Congratulations. Do you think maybe you might look into being assessed as for being autistic? I was like, are you joking me? Like, because my uncle is autistic. There's a couple of autistic people in my family and their presentation is completely different to mine. You know, they're pre-verbal or non-speaking. And their support needs are much greater than mine. So I was like, I'm absolutely not autistic. One, I'm a girl. Two, I'm terrible at maths. I'm looking at you in the eyes. I can make eye contact. You're being ridiculous. And so she didn't push it because she was lovely. And then the second time it was suggested to me, she suggested to me again another time. And then my nana was dying. And obviously, I was very, very close with my nana, and so was everyone in the family. But I could see that other people were dealing with the grief of this differently than I was. And so I knew that she was going to die, but she was in hospital for maybe 3 weeks and it was touch and go. And other people had sort of started to process that this was going to happen. And I went to the GP because I was so anxious. And I was like, I just need to know when she's going to die, why she's going to die, why can they not fix her? Like, it's not sufficient for a doctor to tell me that, you know, human life is mysterious. Like, this is a specialist. They should know what's happening. And basically just the disruption of my routine and all that kind of stuff was really upsetting to me. So she suggested again. And when a third person suggests it to you, it's like, okay, fine, I'll do the assessment. And then
it's interesting what you say about your uncle and another member of the family, and that, you know, non-verbal or pre-verbal high support needs and everything. It'd make you wonder, and look, you and me don't have the answer to this, but is it unhelpful that that the way you are is called the same word as the way they are, when there's obviously a world of difference there?
I think so. Do you know that? And a lot of people in the autism or autistic dependent community would disagree with that. But I've had people, like, since I've disclosed publicly, I've had people come to me and say, like, you're not, it's not fair that you're, you know, you're the public face of autism at the moment because you're nothing like my son and he can't speak and he can't communicate with us. And, you know, it is difficult because it's so broad and it means, like, what we're trying to do in general is trying to get autism more, like, autism awareness, I think we've ticked that box, but autism acceptance, we're not there at all yet. But it's obviously very hard for the public to accept autism if they can't learn a rule that's like, okay, if a person is autistic, here is how you treat them.
Yeah.
And these are the accommodations that they need, when it's so vague. And, you
know, of course, it's a spectrum, as we know, ASD, like, but at the same time, the spectrum is very wide, isn't it?
It's very wide and it's confusing. And, like, after I was diagnosed, I was like, this is ridiculous. I hate this. Like, this, I don't believe in autism at all. And it's just so, I just think what I believe in is things that I think if the world ended today, right, and it started again next week, what are the things that would be replicated again and again? So eventually, if the world ended and started again, someone would discover that the circumference of a circle is exactly twice the radius, right? They would rediscover it because it's empirical. Someone would discover, like, oh, when you drop an apple, it falls to the ground, and someone would discover gravity because it's science, right? It exists. Would someone be like, oh, there was a woman and she didn't have sex, but she got pregnant and she was the Virgin Mary and Jesus was on a cross? Probably not, right? Because it's a story, but there would probably be another story that would explain things to us. And I think with autism, we would see, what we would see is that, like, there are these people who behave in a certain way, right? Neurotypical people, generally the public, are like this. And then there are people who diverge from that. And they diverge in different types of ways. But I think to pool everybody who diverges in similar ways as autistic is difficult for the community in terms of what they need in acceptance and awareness, because no two autistic people are the same. And it means that we have more work to do to help people understand that my brain is different to your brain, and I need some support around that.
Yeah. Was it a bit of a shock all the same to be told you're autistic?
It was a shock, but not a surprise by the end, because, like, you'd filled in all the forms. I was reading Why Can't Everything Just Stay the Same? And at that point, I was like, this makes so much sense. Like, it just makes so much sense to me. And
your mother wasn't surprised?
No, she wasn't surprised at all.
And was Noel surprised?
Noel wasn't surprised either. No, he's been amazing. Because he was the one who, because he's such a social butterfly, like, Noel can go into the room, he will always gravitate towards someone from Mayo, seek them out, talk about Mayo things. He's just a real chatterbox and real, really social. Whereas I get calcified in fear, like, you know, and he's really good at helping me. So he'll say, okay, so we're about to meet these two people. And remember last time we met them, they were getting a dog. So you could ask them about that. And we have, like, little signals where I need to leave. And he was kind of the one who was like, yeah, you definitely struggle with social interactions and with routine and needing a, you know, like, we can't just go on holidays and see where the wind takes us. Like, we have to have a plan for every day. So he wasn't surprised either, no.
So are you relearning now how to be in the world, or is everything just the same but you understand a bit more where you are the way you are?
That's a bit of a struggle, because it feels like, now that I'm autistic, there are ways that there's things that can support me. But it's a fine balance, isn't it? Like, do I need support to become more acceptable in the world as a broken neurotypical person, which is what can be, it can feel like sometimes, or can I just be myself?
Okay, yeah.
And that depends on the company that you're in and who's helping and how you are received. Because sometimes it can feel like autism acceptance is about being given more time and more grace to do things the, inverted commas, proper way. But that's not what acceptance should be. Acceptance should be like, oh, okay, so you don't like making phone calls and you can't process things at the same speed as other people can. Like, for example, I've had reason to be in hospital this year. Everything's fine. But, you know, if I'm in a hospital room, the overhead lights, the noises from the machines, the fact that different nurses and doctors come in, I can't really retain what a doctor is saying to me. And so I often would leave and be like, I don't know what they told me to do. And then it's a lot of Googling and anxiety. But now I'm able to say, listen, actually, I'm autistic and the lights and the noise are really overwhelming me. And I know you can't change that, but could you send me an email with what you need me to do? And yeah, you can feel like a burden because the HSE is so overwhelmed that a doctor doesn't really want to have to be sitting down to write an email. But otherwise, I don't get the care that I need. And okay, so it's kind of a balance of...
Yeah, but you don't want to be fixed.
In what sense? Like, I don't want
this
to be...
Is what you, like, I suppose some people would think, okay, now you've got that diagnosis and now you can be fixed to function better in the world. But you feel no need to be fixed.
But I can't be fixed. Like, I it's not... And that's what I always thought. And there is a grief kind
I'm
of...
I'm not suggesting you should be fixed. You know what
I'm
saying?
I know that.
Is there a grief, yeah?
There's a grief that comes with it where you think... Because I always thought I could be fixed, right? That, like, if I went to enough therapy and I learned the right sequence of words and I learned how to talk about football and the weather, that I would eventually be able to be the same as other people. And there's a grief that comes with going... With learning, like, actually, you can't. Because you're different. And, like, the underlying assumption of needing to be fixed is that there is one correct way, there is one correct type of person, and you are not it. And that's what I'm hoping will change, because also some of the best parts of me are the fact that I'm autistic. Like, I know we live in a world where, like, being smart is getting less popular and populism is rising, but, like, I'm very smart and I think that that's an asset. I'm very loyal and honest, and, you know, autistic people are some of the best people that I've met. And we need to, you know, obviously when we're talking about supports and children, and it's obviously the conversation is going to always be around deficits and the supports that they need. Yeah. But there are great things about being autistic too.
Yeah. And then on the other hand, you don't want to romanticize it into that kind of Rain Man side of things either. So it's very kind of, our perceptions of autism, the typical community, are very, it's very complex and tricky to know what's right, isn't it? Listen, is life easier now? Like, you social situations easier? I don't know, general coping easier?
Yeah, like, it's also, I've kind of gamified it. Like, I was at an event recently where I don't like to go to gatherings, but I had to go. And just watching neurotypical people and how they interact, I find just very, very fascinating. This was an event where there was no alcohol, and it was sort of like much to the disgrace of the neurotypical people there who had been expecting it. And neurotypical people, they seem to kind of struggle to gauge the ending of an event if there's no alcohol to run out of, because that's usually what they gauge it on.
Yeah.
And so I've noticed that, like, someone usually yawns and then talks about tomorrow morning. And then other people say, like, well, what are you doing tomorrow? And they all talk about tomorrow. And then eventually someone plucks up the courage to be like, right, well, better let you go. You've that thing in the morning. And instead of, like, when I'm with my autistic friends, I'm like, okay, I'm finished. I don't want to be here anymore. I'll see you later. Just so it's kind of, it's entertaining in a way.
Yeah, and you're like an anthropologist now.
Yeah, but that's the thing. Like, I know people the way David Attenborough knows animals, and that's why I write scripts and I write TV shows, because I'm observing the world kind of as an outsider.
Yeah. Listen, there's a few people texting in. One person says, brilliantly frank and honest interview, very enlightening. There's many people who might recognise these symptoms in themselves, and I think there are. Like, just one texter there, I'm shocked that so much of what is being said applies to me. Where and how can I go about being assessed? I'm 60. So is the first protocol the GP, Stephanie, would you say?
No, well, there is a pathway that the Minister for Disabilities has opened for public, for adults in the public system, but I'm not really sure about it because I didn't go that way.
Okay.
I went through adultautism.ie,
okay.
And there are other places like that you can do it, but that was where I went, so I can kind of say my experience was very good.
Adultautism.ie, but the GP presumably as the first protocol that will be accessible to a lot of people.
Absolutely.
Probably would help. Stephanie Preisner, that was fascinating. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Brendan. Have a great day.